Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear the show there anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's wonderful dot foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Emil Nakle. He is a retired CIA intelligence officer, and is going to be speaking about political Islam. Right now, I would like to welcome Marielle Nanasi. She is a senior policy advisor for New Energy Economy, and she is the curator of the exhibition Vision Shift, Art in the Age of Climate Change, which is opening very soon, all sorts of events going on, which we'll be talking about. And Marcelin Simal, who is an artist who also has work in the show, and he's an interventional cardiologist. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about this art in the age of climate change, Marielle. The original impulse was, you tell us about it.
Thank you for having us on. The original impulse is that New Energy Economy is dedicated to coming up with opportunities to solve climate change. And so we work in the legislature. We work on regulation. Right now we have a legal petition pending before the Environmental Improvement Board to set a carbon cap in New Mexico. And that if it gets passed, it would be the most stringent carbon cap in the United States. And a whole host of other kinds of issues. We have a legal brief pending in the PRC. And we're working on a community level, a grassroots level, as well as a policy level. And I was feeling inside of me this frustration about this process, about the process going too slow, because we are in a very serious moral and environmental crisis right now regarding climate change. And so I was feeling this angst when I would go to bed, and I thought, what can I do about this? And I figured I couldn't be the only one who was feeling this way. And so in a way to deal with my own emotional frustration, I thought, how can I get out of this? And how can I see something in a different way? Where can we have where we are at right now and take us to another place, which is basically requires a shift in our vision, a reimagination of life in a post-fossil fuel world. And I thought, I had heard Arundhati Roy once say that artists have the ability to translate what happens in the boardrooms to mass communicate it to the public in mass way that was understandable. And so I thought, what about Santa Fe is so rich in artists of all kinds, and what if I put out a request for artists who are interested in also expressing their deepest concerns about pollution and environmental destruction, or the miraculousness of human ingenuity and innovation to get us to this new place, a place that's a post-fossil fuel era that we need to get to rapidly by 2020, I'm hoping. Clean energy in Santa Fe by 2020. So I put out this call, and it was an overwhelming response, to be perfectly honest. I first passed it by Lee Rakow at Center for Contemporary Arts, and she loved the idea, but people were not satisfied that that could be the only venue. So they thought, wait a second, we not only need diversity in terms of media, art, the kinds of art, but the places. So we now have six venues, and it's now gone to Warehouse 21, the Institute of American Indian Arts, on the buses in Santa Fe. So right now, if you take the bus, which I encourage you all to either bike ride or walk or take buses more often to begin to change our carbon footprint, you will see on the buses an artist rendition of a Stop the Global Warming, which is just fantastic. It's a polar bear.
Right.
Polar bears and apes saying we got to do something about global warming.
And right, so yeah, we need more. We need our ice in the water, and we need our not to be heated out of existence. Like it's said in a very cute way.
Yeah, and hopefully accessible. And then we're at the Santa Fe Place, which is the mall, trying to reach a whole different audience that probably, maybe this is a stereotype, but probably doesn't go to some galleries.
Well, not everyone goes to galleries, but everyone goes shopping sooner or later.
That's right. And that's and we just hung that show, and it's going to open on Thursday with the mayor. And that's pretty exciting. So the kickoff event is with Mayor Kass reading a vision shift proclamation that he signed and recognizing the seriousness of climate change. And then there's going to be this unveiling that the mayor himself is going to do of a mural by a Diné youth artist, Brian Dixon, which is just an interesting twist because his father actually works in Farmington in the coal mines. And so he has a visceral understanding of what's going on. And the mural is enormous. It's something like 10 feet by 25 feet or something. And it's in the food court, a place where people always go when they go to the mall. And
that's such an interesting story about Brian Dixon. Basically, he is expressing himself artistically, and you know, he may spend his future working in the coal industry as well, or not.
Well, we're hoping not. And his father is really supportive of him being an artist, and also of him taking this stance of saying, "Hey, we need to transition. We need to transition from a coal economy to an economy based on renewables and clean energy." And as he knows firsthand what the results of the health results of living in the backyard of a coal plant is like, with increased asthma and lung disease. And I just heard actually just the other day from a Native American person that the San Juan River, which is where the coal tailings from the Four Corners and San Juan generating plant goes into, is so polluted and so toxic that the people there are afraid to actually use the river water to water their plants. And so that's how serious it is.
Yeah.
And so there's ravaged, the health issues are ravaging the people there. And that's the source of energy that most New Mexicans get their electricity from.
That's where we get our electricity from. And I think it's extremely important when people talk about, and this is getting off the subject a little bit, but it's something certainly that you're involved in a new energy economy, when they think about their own carbon footprint, to really think clearly about electricity and transportation and all of these things, because I think sometimes people will make a big effort to walk a half a mile instead of driving their car, but actually getting involved in some of these solar energy incentives and taking that step to put panels on your house makes way more of a difference than walking 1,000 miles.
It's true what you say, and we really believe that Santa Fe is prime place to transition, to become a renewable energy city. It would basically spark innovation in research and development and green jobs. And so we're hoping that Brian Dixon does not have to go into the coal mines, and that as a community we will collectively come together to demand from our politicians, city councilors, as well as commissioners, to say that this is the society we want. We have a vision, and we imagine a different world for our children.
We're talking to Marielle Nanasi, and I want to ask you, did you find that there were artists already out there doing this work that addressed climate change, or did they do it in response to your call for entries?
Well, both. I have to say that the breadth and the depth of art has been rather beautiful, amazing. I have been lucky recipient of different images coming across my computer screen for the last basically 6 months saying, I want to be there. I want to participate. Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity. And so there is with us is Marceline, who's a cardiologist who has a quote-unquote day job. And he he decided that this was an important enough issue. And then there are Hispanic youth who have drawn on what would have otherwise been discarded spray paint bottles. And the title of those spray paint bottles, a collection of them, is called Art Saves. And then there's this beautiful piece by Ron Procrasso, who is an established artist in Santa Fe, who's given a lot to this art collaborative. And he has a 4 by 6 foot piece entitled What Are We Doing? And it's a picture of the earth. It's an earth flag that has actually been tattered, and it's just bold.
And they're incredible. I mean, I've seen some of the images that just also on computer screen, but they're incredible. And one always worries with art exhibitions or art performances that are about pressing issues that they're going to be didactic and boringer than I'll get out. And this is not the case at all.
I know. It's like there's photography and there's encaustic and there's sculpture. And
it's good. It's just good work.
It is good. It's really good.
Let's turn to Marcelin Simard. So you are a doctor and an artist. How did you get involved with this? And tell us about your interest in dealing with climate change through art.
Okay, basically, as a cardiologist, my job has been to make people feel better. And I'm from Los Angeles. I went to Los Angeles when I was 19 years old to go to UCLA. But then I was doing full-time research for a while to try to improve cardiology and the quality of care of the patients. And then I happened to open an art gallery that I owned for about 14 years in Los Angeles. And then I decided to make art to make people feel better also. And just to, every single one of my pieces is to try to make the world a better world. And I happened to paint all my dreams, because before going into cardiology, I trained in psychiatry, and I was studying dreams, all the different theories of dreams. And since I was about 20 years old, I've been writing all my dreams. And then I used my dreams to release my stress and to give very, very positive messages, because you get a lot of information. And then even if, like, my paintings are kind of surreal and mystical, but the message is always very, very positive. It's always for people to feel better, like for the world to be a better world, like for the planet to be a better planet. It's why, like, the two paintings that I painted for this show has to do, like, one is like it's a young girl dressed in a Korean traditional dress on the planet Earth, and then kind of with her hands up and praying to the moon to bring water, because she was in Mexico at that time and there was a drought, and just tried to bring water to save the population of that city. And then the other painting is kind of like a hair that looks kind of like a Buddha, like a god. It's like the god of Earth, where everything around is like green. And it's a very kind of like happy, hopeful face. It's kind of like a three dimension, and that is very, everything is like, it's very, very positive. And then they give you a lot of hope and a lot of power. My goal is basically to empower people to be aware that they have gold inside of them, and then they can make major, major changes without having to spend millions of dollars. It's just very, very easy to make major transformation and to help the if everybody focuses a little bit, they can make major transformation, most like here in Santa Fe, where everybody comes here for that reason.
Just about.
I think that if I could say one thing, that it's a perfect lead into what I want to say, which is I think that everyone, we're at a time now that everyone must be climate leaders. And for the first time in our life, we have to take responsibility for what's happening in our climate, and whether it's on the individual level, the community level, as a company, institution, a state, or national level. And because we're all responsible for global warming, and if we share in the leadership required to solve it, I think that one of our greatest opportunities for growth in the context of sustainability, and also in alignment with our natural systems, can evolve. And I think that we're really seeing that in this art, just like what you said so beautifully in an artistic way.
Tell us the story of Erin Currier's piece.
Erin Currier is a mixed media artist. She's a very political woman. She's actually the woman who drew the sort of logo, if you'll excuse that, for the Vision Shift Art in the Age of Climate Change postcard and call for entries. And she did a piece. It's entitled Chido. And Chido was an orphan, and now she has dedicated her life to helping other orphans in Ethiopia. And Chido has done this by coming up with, again, innovative, thinking out of the box, thinking out of the old paradigm way.
Just to give a little bit of background, this is a girl who never knew her father. She lost her mother to AIDS, and she was put in charge of her younger sibling or siblings and her whole family at the age of, what, 7 or 8 or something like that, and grew into young adulthood as a leader with more responsibility than most children could ever dream of taking on.
Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful things about the human spirit. And it's why I still have hope, despite the news about climate change, is because we have the people on this planet who can come up, who have that ingenuity, who have the capacity for leadership. And I think that we all need to step into our own leadership. But what she did was she decided to take paper and grow mushrooms. And then sell them. And that money has gone to help the other orphans, and they came up with a sustainable, healthy kind of economic model in order to further positive life and hope for these other orphans. And so that's what Erin's piece is about honoring leaders who take action.
And where is that piece?
That piece is at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
And yours is too, Marcelin, is that right?
Yes, I have two pieces there, yes.
At the Santa Fe Art Institute.
I have a one-person show at Santa Fe CCA on November 6th. It's all about making the world a better world.
So this is very much in the same thing.
Because when I met with Lee Reka, she talked to me about the green, I mean, all that. It's why, like, my show is very, very consistent. In the huge gallery, they have all different installations. And in the gallery upstairs, I have a one-person show that is all about the same thing. Sculptures and paintings. And
so all of this is happening, coming up. So tomorrow, Thursday, October 8th, from 5 to 7, is the kickoff event at Santa Fe Place, and Mayor Koss will be there, and there will be music and DJ and all sorts of good things, and Little Globe will be doing something as well.
Yes, they will be doing an interactive performance piece there.
And then Friday, there's an opening from 5 to 7 at the Center for Contemporary Arts, and John Fogarty will be giving a lecture. Tell us about that.
John Fogarty is the executive director for New Energy Economy. He's also a doctor. And we'll be discussing, again, our opportunity for transforming our carbon footprint and creating meaningful social change within our own community. So I think that's the heart of his message.
Very important. And I think part of what's important about this is the extra responsibility that we, especially in the United States, as the biggest carbon producer, have, not only to ourselves, but to everybody else in the world. I mean, I've been thinking about all the island nations that will no longer exist if we just keep on blithely living our happy lives the way we're living them. And it's easy to become, to be so unaware of how we're affecting others far away. I mean, you can see if you hit somebody across the face and they go, ow, you see that you've hurt them. But when you plug in your appliances and start vacuuming, and then, 100 years later, somebody else's entire nation vanishes, it's not as easy to see, but it amounts to the same thing.
It's absolutely true. The U.S., people in the U.S. have a special responsibility to deal with the earth, the devastation that's happened to the earth, and the human displacement that will, that is and will be occurring as a result of a changing climate.
So much, much more going on. The Santa Fe Art Institute, the Museum of Contemporary Native Arts, right.
Yeah, and then there's going to be also an opening on at Warehouse 21 on October 10th, this Saturday, from 5 to 7, and award-winning slam poet Nolan Eskeets will perform, as well as Ed Masria, who is the visionary founder of Architecture 2030, who talks about the impact of buildings and the carbon footprint from buildings.
And he will be giving a lecture at a little after 7 o'clock at Warehouse 21. Much, much more. Is there a website where people can go and find out more about your work?
Yes, please.
Visionshift.org.
Visionshift.org. It's really simple. And if you have any questions, you can call 505-469-4060. And we hope that you'll come to the openings and support the policy work that's needed to transform our society.
And Marceline Simard has a website, which is marcelinesimard.com. And if you don't know how to spell it, you can go to my website, santafe radiocafe.org, and I will have a link to it.
One more thing is that we're having a rally on October 24th, which is in observation of the 350.org International Day of Climate Action. And Earth Care's Youth Allies organization will host an action to raise awareness about climate change and demand movement by political leaders to cap carbon emissions and reduce carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to below 350 parts per million. And New Energy Economy and Earth Care are doing that, and we meet at CCA at 1050 Old Pecos Trail at 1 o'clock on Saturday, October 24th. So please come out and join our march to the Roundhouse.
I want to thank you both so much for being here. Marielle Nanasi is a senior policy advisor for New Energy Economy, and Marceline Simard is an artist and an interventional cardiologist. And once again, Vision Shift, Art in the Age of Climate Change, is happening starting tomorrow and going on through the month. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment with Emil Nakle. Please stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm delighted now to welcome Dr. Emil Nakle. He is a retired senior intelligence officer in the CIA, where he was director of its Political Islam Strategic Analysis Program. He is the author of the book, A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World, which is published by Princeton. And he is also in a new book. He has a chapter in a new book called Combating Transnational Terrorism, Searching for a New Paradigm, which was published last month by Prager Publishers. And this Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, he will be giving a lecture, which is part of the Santa Fe Council on International Relations series called The Muslim World and Beyond. He'll be talking about political Islam. That's at Santa Fe Prep on Saturday morning. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So let's talk about global terrorism. Global terrorism is in many people's minds associated with Islam, which is certainly not the only perpetrator of terrorism in the world. But who are the perpetrators when you talk about this giant category called global terrorism, and who are the victims in the 21st century?
Well, actually, I will begin with the second question first. The victims are both Muslims and non-Muslims, even though many of those who have committed terrorism in the last 20 years, let's say, most of them have committed terrorism in the name of Islam, of course, a perversion of their religion, but they committed terrorism against both Muslims and non-Muslims. 9/11 is one of those heinous crimes that was committed against the United States, of course. But the victims in New York were from so many countries and so many different nationalities and religions.
So that is some of the victims of terrorism, but of course it's not limited to the United States or indeed Western countries.
That is true. In fact, we've had in the last 10 years terrorist acts committed in, not as you said, not in in Western countries only, but in Egypt, in Sudan, in Indonesia, in Turkey, in a number of other Muslim countries as well. So their acts have been against what they call the traditional crusaders, the infidels, headed by the United States, against international Zionism headed by Israel, and against pro-Western regimes, mostly Islamic regimes, who in their view are un-Islamic in their behavior. So they are targeted. This is what we call the near enemy and the far enemy, what the radicals have described as the near enemy and the far enemy. But what is interesting and what is, of course, encouraging in the last 2 years, and certainly this past year, is that we have seen more and more rejection of this paradigm, of this terrorist logic, if you will, by Muslims themselves. And that is a very encouraging sign. And we actually, it is possible to argue that Al-Qaeda, which represents this radical paradigm, seems to be on the wane. And this is not just wishful thinking, but I believe we have indications to show that Al-Qaeda is finding it difficult to recruit new recruits, to raise funds, and to establish contacts with other like-minded organizations. So we have seen a diffusion of this radical mass, if you will, but we really have seen a rejection, open rejection in the media, in Muslim media, of this radical paradigm only very recently.
Which is very interesting, and I want to talk about that more in a few minutes, but let's stay for a moment with these, the people who are terrorists, who carry out terrorist actions, who are involved in a whole set of ideologies. What are their motive? Who are they? What are their motivations? Why do they get into this kind of work, this kind of life?
Right. This is, of course, a very good question, and without boring your audience with history, it in fact started, at least this phase of Islamic terrorism, started by Osama bin Laden in the early 90s against of foreign troops in Saudi Arabia. That was after the first Gulf War, when we went in and evicted Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, and then our forces stayed in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and Abu Dhabi and so and Oman. And so Osama bin Laden said that Arabia, being the holy land of Islam, shall have only one religion, and that's Islam. It's based on a questionable statement by the Prophet Muhammad. But in fact, that's how it started, and therefore it continued focusing on policies. That is, they began to identify our support for Israel, our attacks on Muslim countries such as Iraq and Afghanistan, and more recently Pakistan, and our support, as I said, support for Israel and anti, in their view, anti-Palestinian policies, our bellicose rhetoric toward Iran and Syria. So they use all of these issues and tie them all together, saying that, well, this is the Islamic cause. And so it moved from those very specific policies to an ideological or religious, narrow religious interpretation of that ideology, to say that this war between their brand of Islam and non-Muslims shall last forever until the final days, when Islam will emerge victorious. So they gave it kind of a religious undertones, but that the fact is it started with a specific identification of policies, you know, rightly or wrongly, but they began on policies first and then moved from there to a so-called religious ideology.
One can have sympathy, if one looks at these things with clear eyes, with some of those objections to U.S. or Western policy, But the methods, namely the methods of terrorism, are very hard to have sympathy with. Why were those methods as opposed to direct other kinds of nonviolent political protest or political engagement chosen?
Well, that's, again, another very good question. And briefly, the answer to that is that in a number of Muslim countries, unfortunately, they continue to have authoritarian autocratic regimes, whether in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Tunisia. So those regimes have not allowed for any political organization, Islamic and secular. That is, there's no opposition, no political opposition is allowed in those countries. So the fact is that Islamic groups, and in fact even liberal groups, secular liberal groups that opposed U.S. policy in those countries could not organize, could not speak out in public, and so they either fell silent or the radicals opted for violence and terrorism because they no longer believed in what they called a gradual change or a changing their political systems from within under the law. The opportunity was not there, so the majority fell silent, and that radical minority pursued terrorism as a vehicle of change.
It's not only that there were autocratic political regimes and so on, but also a lot of these people were young men who really saw no future for themselves, for any kind of economic place in the world, marriage, family, and so on, and that leads people to desperate measures.
Well, that is exactly true, because when you look at the what we call the drivers of radicalism, that is the factors that have contributed, and we have studied that very closely in the last 20 years, not only as part of my job, but in dealing with other academics on this issue, that we've identified at least half a dozen key factors that have contributed to or have driven radicalism. One, of course, is the autocratic regimes and their policies of repression. Two, policies of corruption, poor economic policies, increased poverty, the changing demographics, whereby the population has become younger, less educated, poorer, and therefore more alienated. And so you have a tremendous growth in the population, and yet you don't have sufficient economic opportunity that would provide the young people, especially high school graduates, with any kind of hope for either to get married or to buy a house or to pursue a decent job. So these issues have certainly contributed to the growth of radicalism. And when I was talking to a couple of kids in Pakistan several years back, and I asked them why they were going to do jihad in Kashmir, well, they told me that's a way out. We get a gun, we get money, and we go places. Otherwise, what would we do staying in this little village here?
It does really make one rethink ways to fight terrorism, and it seems like creating grassroots economic opportunity would be far more effective than all the guns in the world.
Well, that's exactly right, and frankly, please forgive me, that is exactly why I wrote this book that you cited in the introduction. And that is that the book argues two, three points which are key to it. And one is that a vast majority of Muslims, they do not support terrorism. That is, those who engage in terrorism tend to be a small minority, and this is by confirmed in public opinion polls over in recent years, the Pew poll, the Gallup poll, and few other polls. Secondly, that we need to engage the vast majority of Muslims on issues that are not necessarily political, as you indicated, educational opportunities, economic opportunities, health issues, the rule of law, things that judicial reform, technological education in their schools, school curricula. So there are many areas that we can engage the vast majority of Muslims throughout the world. And the third point I argued is that engaging these millions of Muslims, the 98%, I call it, you know, the 199%, the 1% of terrorism and the 99% of Muslims who just, you know, live and let live and they want to live. And they have children to educate, they have mortgages to pay, bills to pay, and so on. So the third point I argue that is that engaging these vast majorities of Muslims is a matter of national interest. That is, it is our our country's national interest dictates that we not ignore the 1.2 or 1.3 billion Muslims and just focus on terrorism, because as the previous administration unfortunately has done, they painted the whole Islamic world with a broad brush of terrorism, which gave the impression to most Muslims that our policies, our pursuit of terrorism, really equated with anti-Islamic policy. And so they resented that and they rejected that. And so engaging the Islamic world, I argue, is that it will give the clear impression that we are differentiating between terrorism and the rest, that we are viewing terrorists as criminals and as a group of people that should be pursued and stopped, but that to win, if you will, I hate to use the phrase, the hearts and minds of vast majorities of Muslims, we need to engage them on all kinds of levels, not necessarily at the regime level, but at the society level. Civil society institutions, high school and grade school teachers associations, women's groups, small business groups, small young clerics, and so political parties. So there are a number of indigenous, credible groups that we can engage in order really to defeat terrorism, because as you correctly indicated, we cannot truly reach the Islamic world through the gun. We have to use the gun against the terrorists, but that we need to engage in other social and economic and educational and medical issues, health issues.
We're talking to Dr. Emil Nakle. He's a retired senior intelligence officer from the CIA. His earlier book is called A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. I think it's interesting that you write in your latest article in the book, Combating Transnational Terrorism, that it's extremely important to do international intelligence sharing. So intelligence sharing not only among countries in the Western world, but also between the United States and Western countries and the Muslim world. But because of our behavior, because of Guantanamo, and because of, as you say, painting the Muslim world with a broad brush in a very negative light, and the extreme rendition and so on, all these things that we've done, people don't necessarily want to cooperate with us.
That is true. That that actually happened in recent years. But the other side of that is that some of those intelligence agencies, which of course are an extension of their regimes, cooperated with us for very narrow personal reasons, that is, to serve the interests and the survival of their regimes. So that's a point that we had to keep in mind, that while they were cooperating with us, I guess, they were doing that for their own benefit and their own self-interest. However, what has happened in this past year, particularly since the president's speech in Cairo on June 4, and some of the comments he made in Turkey to the Turkish parliament before that, but his speech in Cairo gave the clear impression that we are making a distinction between the terrorists and the rest of the Muslim world, and that, too, we have a lot of common characteristics, a kind of a single theme, common ground between us and other cultures and other religions, the interest in justice, fairness, mutual respect, things of that sort. And that three, he said that we will all benefit when their economic conditions improve, when their educational levels rise, when their technological savvy improves. We all benefit from that. And so that speech left a tremendously positive impression. The challenge, of course, now is for that rhetoric to be translated into specific initiatives, which I think the administration is pursuing. As one Middle Easterner asked me after the speech, okay, this is a great speech, where is the beef? So we need to see a specific initiative.
What is the role of reaching out to Muslim people in the United States, in Western countries?
Yes, it's in the United States. I suppose I would distinguish between the United States and Europe in this regard, just for the simple fact that, fortunately for us in the United States, we don't have what we call a Muslim problem like they do in Europe. In the UK, in Spain, in France, in Germany, in Holland, and so on. But because Muslim immigrants over the years, over the last century, integrated in society, in our own society, and really have reached all levels of life and success in here. Now, having said that, I would say that if, for example, the United States and the UK, England, want to engage the Muslim world, that process will acquire a tremendous credence and credibility if we engage the Muslim community in this country. I mean, the Muslim community can not just be a bridge to the Muslim world, but that if I don't know whether you finished reading my book, but the first recommendation I make in my book, in the blueprint of engaging the Islamic world, is to appoint a distinguished American Muslim as an ambassador to the Organization of Islamic Conference, that is, to the Muslim world through the Organization of Islamic Conference. Appointing such an ambassador would really give a tremendous signal that we are engaging the Islamic community in this country and that we are willing to learn about the Muslim world from our own Islamic community. And the fact is that when Muslims, as they have done in this country, when they have economic opportunity, educational opportunity, they rise to new levels, as the Pew poll a couple of years ago showed when they interviewed American Muslims. That poll showed that, on the whole, American Muslims are better educated than the average public, have a higher income, per capita income, than the average American, and that's because of their hard work and the availability of opportunity. So the president, in his Cairo speech, said, this type of opportunity, if it is present in many Muslim countries, then we will all benefit from it.
You mentioned before that even terrorist organizations are having trouble recruiting people, and on the more what you might call middle class and educated level, there are people who are really reframing their points of view as well, and some of them are even turning to Sufism for their religious expression. Say more about that.
Well, there is a rise in this Sufi trend. Now, Sufism is a trend in Islam that has been there for many, many centuries, really from the Middle Ages, and basically shuns politics. That it says Islam as a faith is a personal relationship between humanity and God. That it is not political, that there should not be a political state, should not be Islam as a religion, should not be involved in politics, that you, if you want to become a better Muslim, that you should be a better person individually, personally, at the personal level, and not at the community level or the political party level. So they advocate shunning politics, not getting involved in politics. That's one. And two, therefore, it does not get involved in ideology. It does not, Sufi Muslims do do not get involved in fighting regimes, do not get involved in foreign policy, and that's why a number of more and more Muslims are turning to Sufism. That is, they want their religion to provide a moral compass for them and their families and guide their behavior to be better human beings, but they don't want to be associated with the political aspects of the religion. And so Sufism is beginning to take root among more and more Muslims. And in fact, even some regimes are turning to Sufism because they are trying to use it as an antidote to activist Islam or political Islamic activism.
I have to say, when I listen to what you're saying and read what you've written, it really seems to me that if the world as a whole were to share its wealth and resources in a fair manner, most of this would just go away if there were a sharing of resources and genuine democracy.
Well, that is exactly true. And cooperation, you see. I mean, not just a kind of a lone ranger, you see, and trying to redo the world in our own image. I mean, many religions have similar views. Other countries are interested in just leading a better life. And so cooperation with other countries on common interests, I think, will go a long way toward resolving world conflicts. And I don't mean to be, you know, Pollyannish here, or I'm afraid I'm kind of a hard-headed realist, but this is a fact about what we have seen in the last 8 years, is that non-cooperation, going it alone, and using the gun first, shooting for